Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For some 32 years, Julie Zicafus, the naturalist, artist, author, and NPR commentator, has devoted herself to birds, observing them, writing about them, drawing and painting them, and very often saving them, patching them up, feeding them from eyedropper to parrot kibble, and in turn, loving them. She's written a new book on the topic. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. And she's with us today to talk about the book and more. Welcome to the show. And for the first time to the studio, Julie Zicafus.
I'm so excited.
It is. It's very exciting to have Julie in the studio. The Columbus Natural History Society hosts Julie tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the OSU Museum of Biological Diversity. For more information, go to columbusnaturalhistory.org. Or check out our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link for you there if you want more information about that. So, Julie Zicafus, you write about your empathy for birds in this book, and it started with a turkey at a petting zoo.
It did. It did. I was very small. We had just moved to Richmond, Virginia. This was probably about 1963, 64. And my dad took me to a petting zoo, and I got right up next to the fence, and there was this enormous turkey, and it was all puffed up. You know how turkeys just kind of like waddle around like they – and my dad said, reach over the fence, feel his head, pet his head, see how warm it is. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I could touch it. And I touched its head, and it was incredibly warm, and the turkey didn't peck me, and it didn't fly away. It just stood there, and I thought, oh. There's someone in here. I can understand this animal. And it was that warmth coming through my fingertips that got me into birds.
I think one of the surprising things about just from reading the book, and I've talked to you many times now, and I've read your other book, is the touching and how much you touch the birds and how much they let you touch them. Mm-hmm. I think we just grow up thinking they'll either peck your eyes out, you know, thank you, Alfred Hitchcock, or something.
Right.
And it's not really at all that way.
You know, it's too bad. I think that movie and Daphne du Maurier's novel, The Birds, or short novella, I guess it was, kind of did birds a lot of damage. You know, it always amazes me how many people kind of duck and cover their heads when they're around free-flying birds. And I think a lot of that is just a natural phobia of having anything come at your head. But for me, you know, I've grown up with budgies just loose in the house, just kind of willy-nilly landing on my head and then macaw on my shoulder. And then, of course, with my wild rehab birds, I'm their mom. They sit all over me. And what's really, really a kick is when I've raised something, you know, wild, like a cedar waxwing or a wood thrush, and I have visitors over to the house, and the bird will fly up and land on a shoulder, and people just kind of go, yeah. but you know, yeah, it's they're very tactile creatures. They preen each other, and they like to be touched, especially when they're young.
My guest is Julie Zicafus. She has a new book out. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go onto the Facebook page. Julie and I both have posted on Facebook this morning. And if you want, you can go right there and post a question or comment. To your heart's content. You conjured the word trust in talking about the time you tried to revive a female hairy woodpecker that had flown into your plate glass window twice. Mm-hmm. And trust entered into it a lot in a lot of these stories.
Yes.
You might not have used the word exactly, but it did.
Well, I have to be careful in writing about birds because I don't want to project feelings onto them or, you know, abilities or capacities that we consider uniquely human. But the situation with the hairy woodpecker is that she hit my window twice in a row in the span of a couple of months. And both times I went out and found her and picked her up and just held her and warmed her until she was kind of coming around. And then I put her out in a low crotch of a tree where no predator would see her, and she just kind of like clung to the bark until she was okay. And the weird thing that happened after that is I would go out to fill the peanut feeder, and she wouldn't move off the feeder when I would fill it. Now, she wasn't so addled that she was still, you know, comatose or something. She was just a wild bird who had figured out, I think, that I was not a threat. It's kind of neat.
Well, that happened several times with lots
yes.
of different birds.
Yes, I had a bluebird, a male bluebird, who was sitting on our clothesline. This is way back in, I'm going to say, late 90s. And this bird was sitting there, and a sharp-shinned hawk came out of nowhere. They nest on our property as well, and this is in summer, and it grabbed this male bluebird off the clothesline, and my husband and I witnessed this and kind of abandoned our don't interfere sensibilities that we should adhere to, and we both went and ran at the hawk,
save the baby,
waving our arms. So the hawk obligingly dropped the bluebird. I picked it up, stretched out its wings, checked for any breaks, any punctures, a couple little punctures, nothing terrible. And so I let him go right there. And he didn't come around much for about a week. But after that, he had a very droopy wing. And I kept an eye on him because he was feeding a brood of five young in our yard, in a box in our yard. Well, one day I was weeding underneath the bird bath, and I felt water hit my back, and I heard a splatter, and I looked up over my shoulder, and the bluebird was bathing about 2 feet away from me. And I thought, okay, there's something going on here. This bird and I have connected. He went on to nest for 8 more years in the yard and raise, I think, 57 more young. So that's what the book is about. It's about what happens when you stop to help, the kind of magic stuff.
Well, the butterfly effect, too.
Exactly. I stole it from the butterfly effect, where mm-hmm. a butterfly, if you don't know what that is, a butterfly can flap its wings in Brazil and cause a, you know, giant storm in the South Pacific, theoretically.
And so if you save that bird, what was the...
What rolls out from then on? Mm-hmm. And that's what my storytelling is all about. It's about being there to notice the follow-up and to connect with the individual bird and to see what happens after you intervene in their lives.
Okay, here come the how-to questions.
All right.
614-292-8513 if you want to talk to Julie Zickafoos. She's right here in the studio.
How exciting.
You can turn on the television if you have a chance. You can turn on the TV and look at her on television. You can go online. It's streaming live at WOSU.org/allsides. She's here, people. This is an email from Tom. He says, could you please ask your guest the diameter of a hole that should be on a birdhouse for various birds? Particularly, I'd like to attract finches and would like to know the correct size for them.
All right. Trouble with attracting finches is that there are no finches that will nest in a nest box. The only birds that nest in nest boxes are bluebirds, titmice, chickadees, nuthatches. Finches are feeder birds. Okay? So, feeder, they're coming for seed. But they don't nest in cavities. Finches make open cup nests in shrubbery. Okay. So that aside, the best hole size that you want for any bird box in a suburban setting or even a rural setting is 1.5 inches. 1.5 inches will admit almost all of the birds you want and will exclude birds like starlings that you don't want.
Why do some birds like boxes and others open nests?
It's just an evolutionary thing. I mean, there are... It's very interesting, actually. They're cavity nesting flycatchers. They aren't terribly common. Most flycatchers build open cup nests, but there are a couple species, like the great crested, the genus Myarchus, all nest in cavities. It's very much hardwired in their evolution. You know, they either nest in holes in trees or they don't. It's not something that a bird will simply take up. Oh, I think I'll nest in a condo this time. You know? So some thrushes nest in holes. Most thrushes are cavity nesters, but the bluebirds happen to be thrushes that nest in cavities. Most thrushes are open cup nesters, mm-hmm. but there are a couple of species, the bluebirds in particular, that nest in cavities.
We have the sound of a ruby-throated hummingbird, and I thought that we could listen to that, and then you could talk about the hummingbird, because when you were talking about nests, I was thinking about the hummingbird nest and how it's made of cobwebs, and it seems just so almost like a fairy tale.
It is.
Let's listen to the ruby-throated hummingbird. With a cardinal in the background,
yes,
Julie Zickafoos just said.
There's almost always noise pollution in these bird recordings.
The hummingbird story, it's about four babies, the size of my fingernail, apparently, from the way you describe them, because the nests are only the size of a walnut.
Yes.
When I was reading the story, I kept holding my fingers up to about the size of a walnut and thinking, okay.
Yeah.
I had to keep getting some kind of frame of reference for it.
And imagine now, Anne, having somebody bring you two of those walnut-sized nests in the same day, each one packed with two little tiny baby hummingbirds, and having that suddenly be your problem.
And the calls actually came within minutes of each other,
and I thought it was the same woman calling because they were from the same part of town. We'd had a straight line wind in July that knocked down branches and trees, And both women lived in Reno, Ohio, and both of them said, I have a nest with two tiny baby hummingbirds in it, and it's lying on the ground in my front yard, and what do I do? And I said, well, gave them directions to my house. Well, first told them to, if they could, put the nest, wire it back up in the tree where it fell from, if they could. If no bird came after an hour, to call me again. And they both called me again.
And you became the adoptive mother of four baby hummingbirds.
Yes.
A couple days off from each other, but
yeah, they were, and thank goodness they were feathered. They were, you know, their pin feathers were bursting the sheaths, and they were beginning to look like birds.
Versus
naked and so tiny, you can't even, you know,
their little blue eyes and in the wrong way blue.
Right.
It's just I'm trying to visualize how you even hold something like that.
Well, you really don't. I left them in their nest.
Yeah,
they had basically ridden the nest down like space capsules out of the tree when the branches broke, and cradle will fall. And they were fine. They were uninjured, and they were ready to rock. And I one of my friends, Jean, says, one of my favorite things about you, Julie, is that you happen to have on hand a jar of hummingbird maintenance formula. Why, yes, right next to the pepperoni.
In the refrigerator,
exactly.
By the way, people.
Oh, there's
it's
much worse.
It's one thing if it's just stuck out in the garage with the, you know, with the oil change equipment.
Oh, no, no.
But
no, it has to be refrigerated in. And it costs $79 for a jar about this big.
So no wonder you're not tossing it out.
You do not toss it out. It's powdered. Mm-hmm. And then you stir it up. But what I figured out was that was not going to sustain these babies because it didn't have a high enough protein content, and it didn't have any amino acids, you know, from live food. And surprisingly enough, hummingbirds feed their babies a whole lot of insects. They go around robbing spider webs. They pick aphids off of branches. It's amazing how much gleaning they actually do. So, and fly catching. So I solved that by serving up mealworm innards. Your good old mealworm innards. Those are in the fridge, too.
How many of those do you get a year? I mean, talking amounts, not poundage.
If I'm raising a baby bird, I order 5,000 at a time. And by the time you've fledged out a baby bird, you've probably gone through 20,000 mealworms. It gives you a whole new respect for parent birds, you know? We think we have it hard.
Well, the robbing the spider webs, too, that was another new thing. Mm-hmm. Who knew?
I've seen them do it.
But how smart is that?
Yeah, they go up under the eaves and they'll pick all the little gnats and things out of the webs. Birds are very, very inventive. I don't know if you've ever seen a house sparrow or an English sparrow in a parking lot, hopping around on the ground, peering up at the grills of cars. They'll go right into the grills and pull the grasshoppers out in the summer and feed them to their babies.
No wonder.
Oh, totally. Birds are so on it. They are just on
very
it.
Adaptable.
Very adaptable.
Which was one
very
of the issues
smart.
I wanted to get at when we come back. My guest is Julie Zicafous, natural history writer, artist, author, and NPR commentator. Her newest book, it's not quite out yet, but will be very, very soon. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
New York, Shanghai, Karachi, Mumbai. Many view the world's biggest cities as overcrowded, polluted scars. But as Earth's population ticks past 7 billion, cities may hold the key to sustainable growth. I'm Neil Conan, a special broadcast from National Geographic, Megacities, plus scenes from Japan's nuclear disaster. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 32 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 43. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 29. More sunshine for Tuesday, and a high of 45.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Julie Zicafous, natural history writer, artist, author, NPR commentator. We're talking about some of the stuff in her new book. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. Julie didn't come all the way to Columbus just to see me. She's also going to be the guest of the Columbus Natural History Society tonight, 7:30 p.m. at the OSU Museum of Biological Diversity. Go to WOSU.org or WOSU.org/allsides. For more information, you can also go to the ColumbusNaturalHistory.org website and get more information that way. And by the way, you're staying in quite a place in German Village. Tell us about this.
I'm getting some serious vitamin me over there because I'm alone. I'm not cooking for anybody. I'm not washing dishes. I'm not doing anything except, you know, fooling around on Facebook.
And where are you staying?
Talking with my friends. I am staying at the Victorian Village Guest House on Neal Avenue, and it is so fabulous.
Super duper.
It is super duper. Why anyone stays in hotels when there are places like this in Columbus available, I do not know. I love it.
Well, now they know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We have a great story about a white-throated sparrow. First, let's listen to a white-throated sparrow, and then we can talk about your story.
I might weep when I hear this.
Yeah.
It's okay.
So that cut from the Macaulay Library is inspired by a story, or we picked it out because you tell a very touching story about the rescue and rehabilitation of a white-throated sparrow. It begins in an April evening when you get a call from somebody, as they so often do,
who picked up
an adult white-throated sparrow in her backyard, seemingly uninjured except for its head. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, this bird came to me with its head completely inverted, so that what you were looking at was the bird's throat, and it was looking at everything upside down. And it was trembling and hopping in a circle, as you would do if your head were on upside down. And I thought, the first thing I thought would have been a pesticide-induced torticollis, which is, you know, a neck twist from neurosymptoms.
Because in other words, trembling. A birth defect.
No, okay. Something like if it, say, ate some granulated pesticide off the ground, as sparrows will often do. I thought there was neuro involvement. Mm. And so I set about administering an antidote to that, but no improvement. Well, after a couple of days and no improvement, I sort of went through the bird with a fine-tooth comb. I wet it down, and I found a knot on the back of its neck where I think it had been bitten by a cat. And I had already started an antibiotic, which is what you do when a bird has been in a cat's mouth, just on the suspicion that maybe there was something bacterial involved. But what had happened is the muscle that held its head upright, you know, all the neck muscles had been badly injured by this cat. So I started physical therapy. I would take the bird four times a day and turn its little head. I'd hold it by the bill and turn its little head about a quarter turn toward normal. And every day, and I'd massage the neck muscles. What else are you going to do? And by, after about 3 weeks, the bird was almost completely right. And it was just fantastic. The way you know, and the bird was incredibly, it submitted so well to this. But the way you know when these things are getting ready for release is when they get fed up with you. So he got really fed up with me, and he didn't want his therapy anymore. As soon as he could feed himself, as soon as his head was upright enough so he could feed himself, he got very uppity.
Uh-huh.
And I like to see that in my birds. I love uppity. So I released him into the yard.
Maybe I'm just imagining it, but it seemed like in so many of the stories you had some kind of phrase to the effect of, and then I fell in love.
With the bird.
With the bird.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't let myself fall in love.
Your brain was trying to tell you, really shouldn't get involved.
I know. I think that there are probably August wildlife rehabilitators spinning in their graves right now as I talk, because I fall completely in love with my subjects. But that's, you know, what I'm in this for is the bond. And the stories that I get out of it, and the feeling that I get in helping an animal and seeing that reciprocated. And when I let that bird go, it stayed in my yard for another 2.5 days. And every time it came out the door, it flew over to a tree near me and sang, which is why I said I didn't think I'd be able to listen to that song without getting a little tear, because it was the most amazing thank you I'd ever gotten. Well, I've gotten a lot of really nice thank yous from my birds, but that was a really special one.
You know, you said in one chapter that starlings know how much we despise them. And, you know, and in others, you make the suggestion that birds are more aware of us and more relatable to us than we realize.
I have to, the way I amuse myself is by going through scientific journals and reading studies like, scientists have just discovered that starlings may actually be aware when we are looking at them. No, seriously, people write this stuff up as if it's news. Anybody who's ever had starlings come to their feeder and has cocked an ugly eye out the window and just given them the, I call it giving them the boogie eye, you know, and the bird flies right away. Of course they're aware we're watching us. They're supremely aware of everything we're doing. They're watching our eyes. As soon as your eyes turn to the bird, it's gone. And but I think what's happening now in animal behavior science is people are trying to quantify that whole bird consciousness, and they're trying to make a case that, yes, there's a brain in there. You know, I've known that for a long time. Anybody who feeds birds or has had a pet bird knows that.
Why do you think it is? Is it just because they're so different than us that it's hard to imagine?
I think
the intelligence.
And that's what I was getting at with the turkey experience, because if there's anything foreign, it's a turkey in display. It's like got this big globby head and this giant weird body. And birds are, they're so unattainable. They're always flying. They're always high in the trees. And we don't stop to think how much like us they really are.
We have an email from Brittany. Writes, this isn't bluebird related, but I'm wondering, she must have been writing this during the bluebird segment, what are those swarms of birds that seem to infest our neighborhood in the winter? They're so loud in the trees. My kids say they're having a bird party. Then something will spook them and off they go again.
Yes, those would probably be starlings, European starlings. And they are very abundant.
That we despise.
Well, I like them. I like them all. But yeah, we aren't wild about those. They were imported from Europe by an industrial magnate named Eugene Shifflin right after the Civil War, I believe. He wanted to import every bird into America that had been mentioned in Shakespeare's works, for
That's
better or worse, right? So the first pair nested under the eaves of the Smithsonian Institution, and everybody was so excited. But now what we get is these winter, fall and winter roosts in cities. Weirdly enough, starlings enjoy roosting on transformers. They like to go into those big, you know, those things that are gated off with chain link fences and have all those bristly looking.
So no one will steal the copper, probably. But yeah.
Right. Exactly. And the starlings sit in there. I don't know if they get a buzz out of it or what, but they do sound like they're having a party. But you know what? Stop and appreciate those birds. Listen to what they're doing. Because I had one that learned to speak in my son's voice in our yard, and it wasn't a pet either.
Yeah, you know, in that chapter you talked about that starlings are, is that the one where you, are they the ones that are having a problem surviving in Europe now?
Yes, it's very, very weird. European starlings and English sparrows are both red listed in England, which is just almost inconceivable to us because
Why
we have
that?
So many. It may have to do with global warming. It may have to do with food resources. In the starling, I believe it may have to do with the fact a unique aspect of the starling's breeding biology is that the baby starling is dependent on its parents for as little as one day after it leaves the nest. Now, that's very unusual. Mm-hmm. Most birds are fed by their parents for 2 or 3 weeks after they leave the nest. A starling fledges well-feathered, flying, and goes off to find its own food. If the food resource isn't available, changes in maybe lawn care practices, pesticides, that kind of thing, it could mean that the starling doesn't survive into adulthood. So it could be some shift in what's available at the time that starlings are fledging. But starlings have a very inflexible nesting schedule. In Ohio, if they haven't laid an egg by June 1st, they will not nest that season.
But all things being equal, they have not had a hard time reproducing in Ohio.
No, they usurp cavities from native birds, and they're, you know, people who are running bluebird and especially purple martin boxes actively discourage starlings.
We have an email from Paul. He writes, we have 2 wren houses that are occupied every season. The entrance hole is 1 1/8 inches rather than the usual 1 1/2 inches. Mm-hmm. According to our friend who built them, the smaller hole keeps larger birds from nesting in the house. Note, wrens are small but have mighty lungs and alert loudly when someone goes too near the house. They're fun to watch.
They are really fun to watch, and it's a good idea if you have wren habitat, i.e. shrubby, scrubby habitat, in your yard. It's a good idea to put up a wren box so that the house wren will enter that hole, have the box to itself, and hopefully not throw out your bluebird eggs in the 1 1/2 inch box hole. That's the problem with wrens. They're great to enjoy. They're wonderful, but they're really stinkers when you're trying to run bluebird trail.
When you're looking at a bird that is in a box, how do you look at the nest? Do you leave the top loose?
No, my box is all open, either from the top or the side or front. And you know that's essential to maintaining bluebird boxes is to be able to get in there and intervene should there be a problem. And there's a surprising array of problems that these birds run into nesting in artificial cavities.
Like what?
Well, for one thing, parasites like the bluebird blowfly.
You said you used bleach to clean out?
Well, I do. That's actually for the mites.
Okay.
The last couple of summers have been horrible for chicken mites, which are a very small mite that sucks blood and can build up to such levels in these nest cavities and in birds' nests that the whole thing looks like it's covered with gray felt that moves. If you can imagine being bitten by that. So, I will go in, and in the case of mites, I'll remove the babies and the infested nest. I'll put them aside. I will dash boiling water into the box to kill all the mites. I'll put the babies in white tissues, and for some reason the mites are attracted to that white, and they crawl off the babies. Mm. Then I burn the nest full of mites, and I make a fresh one out of fresh grass, and I've saved a lot of broods that way. And the birds don't mind. They come back. You know, maybe they understand what I'm doing, but I'll just say this. They will come back, and it doesn't bother them that I'm doing this.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Julie Zicafus. She's been on many times before, but never in the studio, which she is today. She's an NPR commentator as well. Maybe you've heard her there. She's a natural history writer, beautiful artist, author. Her latest book is coming out soon. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. I had an advanced reading copy, not for resale, to look at, which was very helpful. And I was wondering, Julie, this is your second?
This is my second sort of all-Zick production, mm-hmm. where I've written the whole thing and illustrated the whole thing, yeah. I've done a bunch of books before that, but usually I was either illustrating or writing them. I didn't sort of do the combination, the alchemy.
The subtitle is Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. What did you want to get at with that?
Well, what I was getting at is exactly what we've been talking about, the trusts and, you know, being a mother to these things and basically watching them grow up and then building these bonds that I talk about, which in the case of all these wild birds eventually have to be severed. I have to release them and I have to see them go their own way, but I make it as easy on them as I can.
Peter in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a question. I was a security guard in a big warehouse in Delaware last summer, and I regularly feed the birds. There's not much to do in a guard shack. You're sitting there, and you know, I throw a lot of grain and breadcrumbs around and enjoy watching the birds, cracker crumbs. And I noticed a flock of sparrows. They would visit regularly. And there would be one sparrow would crouch down and put its head, lower its head a little bit, and then vibrate its wings. And another bird would come over and feed it. I assumed the bird that's feeding it was the mother bird. And I just wondered, is this bird, you know, it's not a fledgling, is it? I mean, it's flying. Why can't it feed for himself? Is he tricking his own mother?
Well, it kind of depends on the time of year you observe this behavior, but that's a pretty common behavior in house sparrows even after they grow up. It can be part of a courtship ritual. The female will beg from the male and be fed by him. So I'd almost have to see the birds to tell you whether you were seeing
She wants
seeing
to make
a...
sure he can cook.
Yeah, right. I'd have to see the birds to tell you whether you were looking at a fledgling being fed or perhaps a female being courted. But there's an awful lot of that going on with house sparrows. They're great fun to watch. I especially like where the male will droop his wings and cock his tail and sort of hop around chirping. It's pretty cute.
Uh-huh. My father was a pastor, and I was ribbing him once. I said, well, it's written in the Psalms, God has given the sparrow permission to feed on his altar. Because, you know, the original Jewish people sacrifice a lot of different things, bread and everything to God, grain offerings. And naturally, the birds, if you think about it, they would come and feed off the altar. And what a nice place to make your nest, right on the side of the altar. And then you got food for your babies right handy there.
Mm-hmm. So, sure enough.
Would, of course, but they would be pooping all over the altar.
I had a lady once ask me to remove a bluebird house that I had put up in her yard because when the baby birds came out of the house, they sat on her deck railing and soiled it. And I took that box down in a New York minute.
Happens.
Yeah.
Happens.
Goes with
it's
the territory.
It's a natural thing.
I thought, you know
Thank
what?
Thank you, Peter.
You don't get bluebirds.
An email from Lou. I've enjoyed watching the online streaming nesting bird web cams during the spring. I learned so much about eagles watching the nest cam in Iowa. I would love to watch some native Ohio birds. Has Julie thought about setting up a streaming webcam on any of her nests?
She has not. She is too busy poking food into baby birds. You know, I think that's a great idea. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody's done it in a bluebird box, which would be pretty crazy and very, very interesting. I, too, got hooked on the Decora Eagles, the Iowa Eagles. And my 15-year-old daughter got hooked on it. And she would call me and, oh, Mom, come see what they're doing. Yeah, nest cams are incredible. I'm kind of a Luddite about that kind of thing. And I'm only just getting to the point where I can embed a video in a blog post.
I was hooked on the hummingbird nest. I don't know where it was from.
Yes,
it was out in
the
California.
Anna's hummingbird, so, yes. Yeah. And she's like some incredible bird who's been nesting in this place for 7 years or something and just like has two broods a season or three. I don't get that bird. But I'm glad she's out there doing that. And everybody gets so involved with Sassy, the baby who can't fly. Oh.
Well, you know, the bluebird, in the bluebird effect story, that was very unusual how long he lived and also how many broods he had. And also, wasn't he a polygamist?
Yes, he was. Okay. Yes, he was. And that's also kind of interesting. He managed to hold down two females at once in two different boxes. However, part of this is an artifact of our yard, the way it's set up with tons of boxes around, so it's easier for a bird to pull that off. But I also had a Carolina wren who did that, and they are supposed to be genetically monogamous. They are supposed to be hardwired to be monogamous, but I had a polygamistic male Carolina wren who had two females nesting simultaneously in the yard. Here's the thing, Anne. If you watch, these birds are doing this weird stuff all the time. You have to be there to see it. That's the thing.
An email from Marianne. Is it okay to feed birds in winter if every now and then you can't feed them for 2 or 3 days? Also, is it okay to feed deer cracked corn? I read something about acidosis. P.S. I'm looking forward to tonight.
Oh,
okay, Marianne.
Great. I'm looking forward to it, too. Okay. First question was, is it okay to feed birds if you suddenly have to go away and you're gone for 2 or 3 days? I think the way to think of bird feeders is as kind of like a trap line where the birds are visiting a number of different feeding areas in their course of their day. So I think it's very easy to get into the feeling that they are completely dependent on us for their survival. That's actually not the case. I wouldn't worry too much about leaving on vacation, says the woman who often hires someone to come fill her feeders. That kind of depends on weather conditions. If we're having an ice storm and there's 2 inches of ice, yeah, it could be a problem if you've been feeding birds every day and then you suddenly leave during the ice storm. So just use common sense. But if there are other feeders in the area, the birds have known how to forage without you for millions of years. So second question was corn to deer.
Cracked corn for deer, yeah.
Cracked corn for deer. I'm not an adherent. I have neighbors who put out 600 pounds of cracked corn a week for the deer on their land. They have 200 plus acres. They feed them all winter long. Why would you do that? Because you want to hunt them. There's a lot of that going on in Southeast Ohio. Deer were not evolved to eat corn any more than cattle were. Corn is hard on bovid guts. Corn is difficult to digest. It may keep them alive, but it could also kill them in a lean winter when they're getting something that rich and that hot, when they should be eating browse, which is twigs. I'm not a believer. I do throw out a handful or two in extreme conditions for the birds and the deer come at night to eat it, but nothing like 600 pounds a week. That's being done right next door to my land.
Yeah, speaking of eating twigs, I'm naturalizing part of my garden, and they discovered it this year.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Was there a third question there?
Nope. P.S. I'm looking forward to tonight.
Me too.
Oh, they read something about acidosis. Was that what you were talking about?
I'm thinking so. I'm not a deer expert, but yeah. I know that the bovid gut didn't evolve with corn.
My guest is Julie Zicafous, writer, artist, author, NPR commentator, and she has a new book out, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. That's what we're talking about right now. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael C. Hall, the star of the Showtime series Dexter, about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. A tricky role for an actor, because the character is always pretending to have authentic emotions.
In a way, it was liberating to let go of that preoccupation. Does this feel right? Does this feel authentic? Am I telling the truth here?
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. As an 89.7 NPR News sustaining member, your donation is automatic, monthly, and ongoing. No more checks to write, and your member card will never expire. For as little as $5 per month, you'll be supporting great programs. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer, and thanks for your support.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design, where the spring semester of Saturday morning art classes for children and youth begins February 4th. Information and online registration are available at www.ccad.edu.
And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow at 10 a.m. Local community choir blends diversity with philanthropy and music. It's the Harmony Project. And then in the second hour of All Sides, it's Tech Tuesday with a discussion of online charitable giving, technology, and gadgetry. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. Sunny skies today, a high near 43 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, and a low of 29. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Julie Zicafous, natural history writer, artist, author, NPR commentator. You've heard her before. She's in the studio today. Email from Debbie. I have two bird feeders and two squirrel feeders. All was well until a huge Cooper's hawk started making himself at home. I live in a suburban area. Suggestions? What do I do?
Enjoy him.
The Cooper's hawk?
Yeah. Cooper's hawks are becoming the urban hawk. And suburban hawk. They have taken over Columbus. In fact, the place where I'm staying, Victorian Village Guesthouse, has a resident Cooper's hawk that comes bombing through the yard.
What does it look like?
A Cooper's hawk is one of the occipiter hawks. It's one of the slender, long-tailed, white-breasted, usually in the immature is white-breasted with brown streaks, brown back. The adult is this beautiful gunmetal blue with like a robin red breast. Oh, they're fantastic birds. Ruby eyes on the adult. And they are bird specialists. They have long, skinny legs and long, skinny toes, and they grab birds right out of trees and bushes. They're also sort of like a James Bond bird. If a sparrow flies into a bush, the Cooper's hawk will go in after it, throwing aside vegetation as it goes.
I think I've seen a hawk like that go after like a squirrel in a tree or something.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. I wouldn't be too surprised. If it's small enough and it's a big female Cooper's hawk, she might try it. But red-tailed hawks are also a pretty common urban sight now. It's really interesting how in my lifetime raptors have taken to living in cities. To answer your question about what to do, there's nothing you can't actually shoot the hawk or trap it or anything like that legally. They're very much protected by law, thank God. And they are... But this is a behavior that it will show in winter. It's when summer comes, it will go somewhere else probably to breed, maybe a more leafy green part of Columbus, and hopefully leave your feeders alone. But you have to realize that when you're putting out a banquet for birds like that and you're attracting a lot of birds, you're just making lunch for something else. And I choose to really enjoy my occipiters that come to my feeders. I do intervene when they grab my bluebirds. I don't like that, but they're welcome to a junco now and then.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Yes, I'm so thankful for your program again, and your guest, Julie Zicafous. Her bonding with animals is phenomenal, especially birds. And, you know, that's really the way God wanted us to be. And look at what happened to Noah's Ark. There are actually more animals on than were humans.
Good point. Good point, Richard.
We should we should wake up and take notice and say, hey, maybe we better change our ways, you know?
Well, I'll tell you that befriending animals and birds is a lot more interesting than killing them.
Yes, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And you know, as I said to Anne, staying around for their lives and watching them and being able to get involved with one and to see what amazing lives these individual birds lead and the crazy stuff they're doing that we have no concept of. It's really a wonderful pursuit.
Yep, and it's just wonderful to hear somebody that has a solution other than euthanasia as a solution for their so-called happiness. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That really gets to me. And there are people that even think that it's possible that humans they use that as a solution. I mean, there are some people around like that. I mean, they're highly educated, mm-hmm. and you got to be very careful because. Our world is not quite the way it's supposed to be, you know?
Well, Richard, thanks for that call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Sometimes, you know, you talked about euthanasia how do you decide what's a litmus test when you don't think a bird's going to make it in your role as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator.
Well, you give it every chance. Mm-hmm. And euthanasia is sometimes in order when you have a bird with a really bad break, like a crushed shoulder joint, and that bird is obviously very unhappy in captivity. There are some birds that are just constitutionally unable to be in captivity. The occipitan hawks, like I spoke of, the Coopers and Sharpshins, are notorious for being miserable in captivity. They will bash themselves against the wire until they, you know, just destroy themselves. So there are certain birds that you just know are not going to be good candidates for long-term care. And also with hummingbirds, if you get a hummingbird that has flown into a window or been grabbed by a cat and it's grounded and it's not going to get better, just euthanize it because they die very badly in captivity because they have to fly to be a hummingbird, really.
Peter in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you. I've got a question for your guest. Years ago, I reared a couple of screech owls, and that was one of the most amazing experiences in my life. And the question I've got is they eventually fledged and left, and I was just curious, do the parent screech owls need to teach the young how to hunt? The thing that I felt the most troubled about is, you know, were these things going out into the environment without the skills that they needed to feed themselves once they were raised in captivity?
Well, that kind of depends at the point at which you release them. I've also raised a screech owl from a very young thing that was found wandering in a town green, and I took it right back to where it was found and let it yell and yell and yell and, you know, alone there in the middle of the green, hoping that a parent would come and feed it. And when no parent appeared after several hours, I reluctantly brought it home. In order to condition my screech owl for release, I bought him live mice and let them loose on the carpet in the middle of my then apartment. and the bird actually learned prey capturing behavior. Did you give yours an opportunity to do that?
Not exactly. They were chasing moths on the back porch.
Excellent.
Their final place of captivity. I mean, they left on their own. But
yeah.
We contacted a vet in town, and they said, you need to get mice and kill them and cut them up and feed them to the owls.
No, you need to let the owl kill it itself. It's, you know, it's not pretty.
Well,
but
this is when they were
when they
blind.
Were very young.
They were
yeah.
blind. Mm-hmm. When I was doing some landscape work with my cousin, and mm-hmm. the tree went down, and there were two babies were there, and so that's how they started out their journey.
Gotcha. Well, you know, they do have a quite a good set of instincts as far as prey capture, and I would think that would hold them in good stead, but they'd have to learn pretty quick, you know, if they were not getting subsidized. And, you know, I was disappointed that my owl took right off when I released it, and I had hoped it would hang around so I could keep offering the pet store mice at, you know, $2 a pop. But he could eat eight in a sitting.
Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Care. Yep. There is a story you told, you just reminded me of in the book. A baby had been left behind, and
Carolina Wren.
Was mm-hmm. it the Carolina mm-hmm. Wren story? And tell us what you did.
Oh, that was classic. That was wonderful. I have a little copper bucket that's wired up under the eave right next to my front door, and it has raised summer generation after summer generation of Carolina Wrens. This pair this day had fledged five babies. Well, four of the five babies had fledged, and the parents led them off into the woods. And there was one baby that remained in the nest. And of course, I was watching all this and worrying and worrying. And after about 4 hours, it appeared to me that I could hear the Carolina wrens moving farther and farther off into the woods. And I became frantic about, I didn't want to be a teenage Carolina wren's mom. So I took my iPod, and it's loaded with the songs of all the North American birds, and I fired it up, and I first played the song of the Carolina wren, got no response. And then I moved to the woods where I had last heard the family, and I played the alarm call. And the adult Carolina wren shot past my ear. I could hear its wings, headed straight for the bucket, picked up the baby, and took it into the woods. It was awesome. It was like a fine moment.
Yes, success. Mm-hmm. You say that cardinals are the beneficiaries of backyard feeding, which has played a role in the dramatic increase in their range since the 1800s. Very interesting, a description about how they've expanded. Let's listen to the song of the Northern Cardinal. You can hear them calling back and forth.
Oh, is that just me? That is just such a May morning for me to hear all those cardinals. Cardinals about the first bird to wake up in the morning. That just totally takes me back to a May morning lying in bed. I love that. Yeah, and they do love that sunflower seed, and they have expanded their range tremendously, aided by feeding.
And they're just expanding. They're not receding anywhere?
Yeah, not as far as I can tell. That bird is very, very well adapted to suburban setups and, you know, will nest in almost any low shrub. And they have an interesting breeding biology. They will nest. They will keep nesting into October.
Yeah.
They will just do brood after brood after brood. Broods tend to be small, usually two, maybe three young, and they just keep reproducing.
I thought it was interesting. You made the point that possibly the purpose of the small brood is that if they're going to get nailed by a snake or whatever's going to get them, because they are in shrub type bushy things and they're easy to nail, they don't lose as much.
Yeah, exactly. If you have, well, it's a classic example is most birds in the neotropics where there are so many snakes and mammalian predators usually have a clutch size around two, and they will build a tiny, flimsy little nest and lay a couple eggs in it, expecting to get cleaned out, apparently. Mm-hmm. And that's, I kind of look at cardinals as doing that, too. They have fairly low investment in each brood, and if they raise them, fabulous. But the other interesting thing about cardinals is they fledge at about 7 to 9 days of age. They're barely able to, they can't fly, they're barely able to perch, but they want to get out of that nest as soon as possible because it's low, flimsy, very, very dangerous place to be.
Email from Karen. She says, for the past 5 years or more, we have had a pair of Carolina wrens nesting on our covered side porch in a handheld grass seed distributor that's inside a brown bucket.
Lucky.
We have the great good fortune to observe the adults nesting and feeding the babies several times over the summer. Last year, while we were watching one group leave the nest, we noticed that one baby was left behind because it got stuck behind the grass seeder. We took out the seeder and carried the bucket to the brush where the adult birds and other fledges had flown. Was that the right thing to do? Also, I clean out the bucket at the end of the nesting season. Should I do that?
You are doing everything right. That's just fine. If your birds are coming back and aren't offended by the fact that you clean out the bucket, that's great. Carolina wrens keep a very, very clean nest. I've never found parasites in a Carolina wren nest, so it's not absolutely necessary to clean out that nest unless it gets soiled or mite infested. Very unlikely, though. But, you know, if you're cleaning out the nest each time and they happily rebuild, it ain't broke. Don't fix it. You also did exactly the right thing by carrying the baby closer to its parents. I've done that many times. I had a clutch fledge in my greenhouse two springs ago, and they were getting in through a vent hole that I had opened. And I completely loved the fact that I had a blooming bougainvillea with Carolina wrens nesting in it in March. It was awesome. But when fledging time came, one baby got stuck in the greenhouse, couldn't figure out how to get out, and I hand carried it out to the parent.
Email from Sarah, what's the wisdom on heated bird baths? We have just installed one here in chilly Toronto. Should we keep it going once it gets really cold, in other words, freezing? Speaking of which, where do birds get water when it's frozen?
Well, a lot of them will eat snow. They will eat ice. they find open water, they'll travel a long distance to get it. They can also live for a certain amount of time without it. Heated bird baths, you know, there is a bit of controversy. I would say as long as you aren't noticing a problem with birds visiting it, like getting ice on their tails and things like that, you're probably fine. Mourning doves have a habit, I don't know if you've noticed it, but they like to sit on the rims of bird baths with their tails pointing in and poop into the bird bath. It's awesome. But in so doing, they will dip their tails in the water, and when they go to fly off in sub-zero weather, that will freeze very quickly, and they can lose their tails that way by having it stick to a branch, something like that. So if you have a lot of mourning doves and you notice this sitting behavior where they're dipping their tails, you might want to just let it freeze over.
Wallace in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Wallace.
Good morning, ladies. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome.
Playing the sonogram of the cardinal made my day today. And a couple questions I have. One, I'm associated with a cardinal. We have a crab apple bush tree out in our front bed, and the cardinals have frequently nested there. And in the spring and summertime, when the reflection from the sun oftentimes is on our storm door, the glass door in front of, you know, of the...
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. Well, just pecks continuously,
right,
multiple times a day,
right,
for months.
Yes.
I sometimes open the door, and it will continue pecking. And I just wondered if there's something I should be doing to avoid that if it's a frustration to it.
Yeah, well, this is probably an individual cardinal who's living in your yard and knows about this window where he can see the reflection of a rival. He's not trying to get into the house, as you know. He's actually fighting a perceived rival. There are a couple things you can do. If he is attracted to that door, you can put saran wrap on the outside of the door that will break up the reflection and kill it. What generally happens when you do that is they simply move to another reflective surface because they've learned that glass equals rival. So I've had a cardinal move over every window in my house, doing that. And they can be quite persistent. I have a friend in western Pennsylvania who had a female cardinal peck his windows every morning for 6 years, starting at like 5 a.m. as soon as it got light. So one individual bird can get a kind of a screw loose and attack a window for a very long time. Try the saran wrap. Also try artificial snow sprayed on the outside of the window. And the other thing you can try that has worked for me is an inflatable Spider-Man doll dangling from the eave.
And you can get one of those at your local Big Lots. Thank you very much, Wallace, for that call. I just want to read a quick email from Eric, and then we have to say goodbye to Julie Zickafoos. Eric writes, if you are fortunate enough to have birds in your yard that you can hand feed, you can definitely feel the connection. I'll have chickadees perched on fingertips eating sunflower seeds from my palm, and they will look you directly in the eye and make all sorts of little sounds. It feels like conversation.
Oh, it is conversation. That's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
How sweet is that?
Mm-hmm.
One thing in the book, I had to look up some words, which you think is just great.
That's a victory for me. That's a personal
victory. Tarsometatarsi and corvid. And then there's a stepnophidiophobia, which we'll get to the next time you're on the show. Julie Zickafoos, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Julie Zickafoos, she'll be in town tonight speaking. If you want more information, WOSU.org/allsides. Been talking about her new book, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.